The paradox of trauma is that it has both the power to destroy and the power to transform. Hello, and welcome to the Basket Case Immersive on Paul Ulibarri. In this episode, we'll take a deep dive into Yuli's experiences to try and understand what's going on between our ears in those moments, so you can add action and awareness to your bag of trick shots next tournament. Think of everything you're about to hear as a jumping off point for you to discover what works for you and your own mental game. So take it or leave it. Also, the advice you're about to hear is conversational, not clinical. I am not a mental health professional or a sports psychologist, but I do strongly believe that if you've ever had your mental game fail you, you're not weird. In fact, you're in good company. So let's get ready to flex our mental muscles and get into flow. Come on, y'all. I want to thank Paul and all my guests really from this season and last for coming on the podcast. I've been really lucky to have these amazing people who tell amazing stories on my show, and most of them I just happened to bump into and meet during my time in and around disc golf. So thank you so much. When I interviewed Kona last year and shared her Hashimoto's diagnosis and struggles, she mentioned I was the first person she had told in the general public. Of course, my episodes come out much later than recording, but to see her now recovering, thriving, and rocking that gorgeous scar, girl, get it. I am so impressed by you. Each guest on Basket Case shows up and really shares their heart, and Paul was yet another poster child for that. Kudos to you, Paul, for being brave and secure enough to share some pretty big things with us. Thank you. We are the sum total of everything we've experienced, and just because we're trying to play a tournament doesn't magically make your baggage and trauma disappear. We take it all with us, and it's been really beautiful to see, one, how everyone has that baggage in some way, and two, how strong people are. If you haven't listened to Yuli's interview, I encourage you to go take a listen. In his episode, Yuli mentioned how going through a trauma in early childhood affected his ability to enter flow. Flow happens when you become fully immersed in an activity. It includes a feeling of energized focus, full involvement, and enjoyment. Flow is actually an altered state of consciousness and can feel significantly different from our normal waking states. For instance, flow has been shown to be associated with phenomena found in other altered states, including disassociation, the feeling of oneness with everything, and out-of-body experiences. Paul mentioned how, in his opinion, he was able to draw the comparison with flow states and directly relate it to feelings of dissociative, out-of-body experiences he felt during traumatic moments of his early childhood. Sometimes when traumatic experiences happen to us, our brains try to protect us with a tool called depersonalization. Depersonalization can look like emotional numbness in response to the world around you or seeing your thoughts, feelings, and body from the outside. You might remember the experience of your trauma like you're floating in the air above yourself as it happens. This is like the checking out of the brain's emotional responses, or Paul's brain saying, "Nah, I'm good." This experience also sounds oddly similar to when someone who had a great round immersed in a flow state the entire time say, "Yeah, I was just totally playing above my head." That out-of-body emotionally stable state is like gold, chef's kiss. But, and this is so important, guys, you absolutely don't have to have gone through a trauma to get there, even if there are some marked successful athletes who have. British tennis player Andy Murray survived the 1996 massacre at Dunblane Primary School in Scotland by hiding under his desk. Age 8. An American gymnast, Simone Biles, spent her early childhood in the foster care system. Research suggests that many of the world's greatest athletes may have similar stories of childhood adversity. One study led by sports psychology professor Lou Hardy compared 16 Olympic champions against 16 non-medaling Olympians. All of the medalists were exposed to traumas as children, including parental death or divorce, physical and verbal abuse in an unstable home, compared to only 4 of the non-medalists. This is fascinating, hopeful, and encouraging that trauma could have a so-called silver lining in sports. It runs counter to everything we think of, that childhood traumas lead to negative health outcomes, substance abuse, depression, and obesity. Not exactly ideal ingredients for athletic success. The trick is that trauma may present itself as a unique learning opportunity for some people, but is far from a recipe for global success. Just because you've had a hard life won't make you a world-class athlete, and there is absolutely more precedent for developmental traumas in early childhood to lead to poor health outcomes later in life. So don't be a dummy and thrust adversity upon someone with the assumption that they will benefit from the experience. There was, however, one distinction in studies that found that super elite athletes typically experience some sort of foundational, negative, critical life event that was then followed by a positive sports-related event. So the trick was that sports became an outlet, and a positive one. Not only did sports and competition become a positive outlet to channel energy, emotion, passion, and aggression, the athletes that turned trauma into triumph became resilient because the challenge was followed by support and positivity. I've been able to spend some time with Paul and his family. The first time I met them was a dinner full of warmth and laughter, where Pete, Yuli's older brother, and Pat, his mom, were planning to pull a prank on Paul as they picked him up from the airport. They were planning to have Pete walking down the side of the road, hiding his face and hitchhiking, and they would pick him up and freak Paul out. They laughed about this plan so hard before it had even happened. And of course, Paul saw right through it, but the jokes, joy, and laughter flowed as freely as the wine. I have no doubt that Paul's ability to become the athlete he is today is a credit to his support system growing up. In the episode, he talks about his brother and what that dynamic and relationship did for his competitive growth. I really love this and wanted to have Pete come on and talk about it a little bit as well. So here's my interview with Pete.
I just got back from his and Sarah's wedding. Had the opportunity to, I was his best man, so I kind of had to do a best man speech. And so I've been mulling on that kind of stuff for a while. A couple of the guys were like, "Do you have it written?" I'm like, "What written?" And they're like, "A best man speech." I'm like, "Oh, I got stuff in my head." And they're like, "You're going to wing it?" And I'm like, "Yeah. Commitment."
Commitment, yeah, is, yeah, commit to it. Don't put it to paper, it'll change.
If I write it down, it'll sound, you know, canned. And I don't, it's not kind of how I am. I like to think in the moment of what, you know, some of the stuff. And so I kind of touched on this actually during that was I was born, then a couple years later came my sister Pam, and a few years later came my sister Patrice, and I was the only boy. And at this point in time, we had moved out to the country. My family got pretty religious, and we were out kind of being quiet out there. And I didn't, you know, when I was younger, I played sports like peewee football and little league baseball. And then we kind of got to a place where we didn't do competition, kind of a thing. And it sounds kind of odd, but I mean, there's a lot of different, ways that people live in the world. So like, but I was like this competitor at heart. I feel like I would go out and throw a baseball against the wall of our trailer and just like catch it. And I was always practicing to be the best baseball catcher in the world or whatever. Right. Just always imagining I'd like throw the ball, catch it, catch the ground ball, throw it back and hit. And like, you know, it was always just this game of speed. And so I played a lot of games with myself. Now my little sister learned how to throw a football pretty well, so we could play catch. And these are just like vague memories, right? Like I'm talking like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 in those, like 8 to 10, 12, right in there. I started riding my bike and like, I, you know, when I was riding my bike, I was just like jumping a dirt hill I had built or a brick and a board. And it was like, could I go the furthest in the world? You know, like I was always like, had this idea of being the greatest and the best at whatever I was doing. And then they said, "Hey, we're going to have another kid, it looks like." And I was like, "Please, God, let it be a boy." Now, this is a 9-year-old boy. who's going, just please, not another girl. I need a buddy, you know. And like, once again, that's not a knock on sisters, right? It's just that boys are boys. And so we went and had this ultrasound, and they said, boy, we think it's a, we don't know, it might be a girl. And I about cried there. And then when they finally came back and said, it's a boy, I did cry.
Oh.
And you know, the interesting thing about it is that you don't think about, like, when you're 10 years old, that you're going to have a 10-year difference. Mm-hmm. And how big of a difference that is. Because most of the time, the older brother that's got 10 years, you know, by the time that kid's 10 years old, you're 20,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you're headed off, you're off to college, and you just don't know your siblings in the same way that I would, like, know my sisters or my nearest sister, you know, like, we were really good pals, you know. But I was in a certain situation where I worked with my family. We built homes together, and like, I basically lived at home till I was about 28. We had a wonderful relationship, and what that afforded was that I had this little brother that, you know, when he was 6 or 7, he could barely see over the ping pong table. and obviously, like, you know, I never really at that point thought, like, oh, I'm beating my little brother. It was just like, it was finally somebody to hit a ball with. And so later we moved to Arizona, and back, I mean, we're going to fast forward a little bit, and you know, I'd go build homes. I get off work, I go by, pick him up from school. We'd go to the golf course. I took up golf, and we could play golf for $5, a twilight golf. And so he learned how to play golf. And within, you know, a month or two, he was beating me at golf. And later became just like, you know, he ended up being like number 2 in the state by points in the junior tour. And like, I think he won the state championships in his division the one year. It was like, it's just unreal, you know, like, and he did it with all the garbage clubs we pulled out of the used bin at our local municipal. And so it was always just like this, I had somebody to play with, you know, like, and then we'd leave the golf course and go to the skate park. I don't know how I thought of it as competition. Yeah, I didn't want to let him off easy. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, you're not going to beat me. So, but I, you know, there was that competition, but he just had this like drive to just beat me. And later he took up disc golf. And at that point in time, I was competing and riding my bicycle pretty heavily. And so I'd play once a year with him and my dad. Maybe I got to the place where I couldn't even like do certain tricks on my bicycle, like ride a wheelie without my knees hurting. I just, you know, you do that stuff for 15, 20 years that your body kind of gives out on you. And I needed some other outlet because I just competition. That's just kind of what I've always been driven by. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just pick up some discs. I got some discs in the back of my truck that I got from my dad and my brother. And maybe I'll go do that, call my dad and go play around with him. And so I just kind of, as an idea, going like, maybe when my brother's back in town, I can catch up with him and my dad and we can play some, you know, and that's what they love to do. So I took it up, and within, you know, the first like little bit of going out and just doing the intending to do this, I just fell in love with it. And just like, it's kind of changed the whole trajectory of what life has been the last, you know, 15 years.
Yeah.
So yeah, like it's kind of funny that it's kind of come full circle where it jumping into disc golf was kind of a way just to reconnect with my dad and my brother, because, you know, our lives had kind of gone slightly different directions, and I was on my bike more and not doing, you know, basketball and these other things, and now it's kind of come back around that it is that choice actually led to, you know, a lot of my personal growth and a lot of what's gone on with where I'm currently.
Pete is such a thoughtful, intelligent person. I also asked him to share some of his personal stories or struggles with his mental game, what he's been a basket case about lately. And here is the story he told me.
A number of years ago at the Tree Bash Open in Flagstaff.
Love that tournament.
I was what is now hole 18 when it was in its short position with the modern hole 18.
On like which course?
On Thorpe.
Oh, okay.
So they had it as a par 4 this year. It used to be in a short position. It's like 280. slightly mm-hmm. downhill through that tunnel gap. And I threw a great shot, and I had what amounted to like a 20 footer just below the basket. And like, I got over that putt, and those things in my head said, well, you've made every putt thus far, but guess what, Pete? It's now your turn to miss. And I was like, no. Like, why are you thinking this, dude? Like, this is not you. Like, you haven't missed yet, so don't worry about it. But I'll get reset myself, get ready to putt. Here it comes. You're gonna miss.
No.
You
know?
It just
no
goes
way.
Like, yeah, it's your time. Don't worry about it. You know, nothing to worry about here, Pete. You just you're due. You're due for a miss, and this is the one you're gonna miss. And like, I stood up and I backed off my putt again. And I'm sure, like, I still feel that, like, I'm sure I look like an idiot.
Yeah.
Here's this guy.
And everyone's like, oh, putter. He's in his head.
Yeah. This guy's grinding over a 20-foot putt maybe he's 18. It wasn't far. I know it wasn't far. I just went back and I sat back and I'm like, listen, you're going to think only one thing. Only one thing. Target. That's all you're thinking. And you guys can talk to me all you want, but all I'm thinking is the target. And I lined myself back up and I looked at it and I dropped my arm, said line, and I reached out to the basket and I said target. All the while we're like, there's this like amped up speaker in my head's going, you're going to miss, you're going to miss, you know? And I made the putt.
Yes!
And like, I just, it was like the great, like I clapped, yeah, like this fist pump,
everyone's
you know, double
like,
fist pump in my
congratulations.
Chest. Congratulations. And I'm sure I looked like an idiot. He's making a
you
great
made
cheer.
That putt.
but that was a place where I gained one of my mantras that like, when I line up to a putt, the number one thing that I can do when all of the other noise is going on, when your brain is shouting at you, is just like there's that one swan in the middle of all the geese. The geese are going, wah, wah, you know, like you can look and go, you can tell your brain to think one thing. At least us as guys, this is kind of our, this is a guy's superpower technically. This is probably what annoys most women about men is that we just have a one track mind. We can go duck in the water, get it, right? And that's all we can think about. Like we don't see that there's sharks and we could die. We just like go get the duck. And so like to be able to just drop my arm and go line, like the swinging on the line, target, as I'm swinging up to make the putt, target. That one moment is the only moment I have to control in my throw. It's the only one that I have to like, and so I can kind of override all the other thoughts by almost verbally saying target as I'm throwing to the target. And that helps me like focus on that one moment, that one point. And that's 1 second of all of the golf round that I have to focus. Even the 30 seconds leading up to it or 29 seconds leading up to it.
Right.
I don't have to be focused that whole time. I have to make decisions. Yeah. I tell myself, I'll step back and go, Pete, do you want to make this putt? And then I've got to like it's silly these things, but it's like tricking ourselves to be good players.
Yeah.
And so I say, Pete, do you want to make this putt? And I feel like I can go yes or no. Right?
Like, yes.
That's really as simple as it is. And if I say yes, then that opens me up to committing to the yes.
Yeah.
If I say no,
because it's like, oh, it's not about, oh, do I feel like I'm gonna make it or do I? No, do you want to make it?
Do you want to make it?
Yes.
If I go, yeah,
yeah, okay. Actually, I do want to make it. So let's go from
can you commit to it? Yeah. All right. Then right in that moment is like that gift that we can give ourselves of, do I want to make it? Yeah. Okay. There's the gold. If the answer is like, do you want to make this putt? And you're kind of like, I feel really scared. Then you can like, okay, are you going to commit 100% to the layup so that you do it and execute it well so it doesn't roll OB? So like there's the two commitments, right? Like it doesn't have to be this in between, like, do you want to make it? Well, let's see what happens. And then you're mad because there was no commitment and like you saw what happens. And most of the time when we're uncommitted, we don't get committed results.
Right.
And so like right there was that one moment at that one tournament where I just said, line, target. You know, I asked myself, do I want to make it? The voices in my head said, well, it's not possible.
And they were still screaming at you. That was my favorite.
Oh, man, it was loud. It just, like, was so funny because, like it was a major victory. And it taught me a lot about, like, how to overcome, even when the noise is there. I can just say, line, target, boom. And like, you know, caveman throw rock in wall, you know, like it was just revert back to that most basic instinct as a human that I possibly can have. And that has taught me so much about how to commit and how to get through that noise.
Pete, thank you so much. This was so good. I might have to put your stories in like 3 different immersives.
Well, thank you so much for the privilege to be able to share.
Of course.
The greatest thing, like I've always thought I wanted to be able to share or help in this way. But like, you know, the funny thing about it is like we can't share or talk about the things until we've been through it really adequately. And the humility to say, man, like, I know what it's like to struggle. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Thank you again to Yuli and Paul for sharing. If you have a mental game story and want to be on a Basket Case Immersive, get in touch. I'll read your send on the show or schedule a time to record. As always, sources from this episode are linked in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, full send everybody. No guts, no glory, no brains, no chains. Goodbye.
Bring that picture up to the front of your mind, whatever that negative crap is, and burn that shit.